We have some questions from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, the 10th of May. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. Counselor to the President, Kellyanne Conway, went on CNN this morning, one of several White House advisors making the rounds to explain the firing of FBI Director James Comey. It was an interview in which, at one point, Ms. Conway said this.
You know, you want to question the timing of when he fires, when he hires. It's inappropriate.
In point of fact, that's exactly what a free press in a representative democracy is for, asking questions. And so, as I said, we've got some. Given the way things like firing the FBI director tend to suck all the air out of the room in political Washington, what do you suppose is going to happen with all the economic stuff? Like this.
To launch our national rebuilding, I will be asking Congress to approve legislation that produces a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure of the United States, financed through both public and private capital, creating millions of new jobs.
The president, obviously, in his address to Congress back in February, the same now distracted Congress that is going to have to pass an infrastructure bill. The House, as you know, did pass a health care bill last week, after which, in the Rose Garden, the president talked about what he would like to get done next.
We're going to get this finished, and then we're going, as you know, we put our tax plan in. It's a massive tax cut, the biggest tax cut in the history of our country. I used to say the biggest since Ronald Reagan. Now it's bigger than that. Also, pure tax reform. So we're going to get that done next.
Technically, what's going to have to happen next, because of the way the budget rules work, is that the Senate is going to have to pass health care, the same Senate that is now going to have to confirm a new FBI director, oh, by the by, and then it can get going with tax reform. One more piece of tape for you. Big picture economic stuff from Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin as he rolled out the administration's tax plan last month.
The overall economic plan consists of massive tax cuts and tax reform, regulatory relief, and renegotiating trade deals. And with that, we will unlock the economic growth that's been held back for too long in this country.
Should be said here that the White House can, in fact, do a lot of regulatory relief without Congress. Not so much, though, all the rest of it. One more question prompted by this comment from the CEO turned president in the Oval Office this morning. He was asked why he fired James Comey.
Because he wasn't doing a good job, very simply. He was not doing a good job.
Okay, so here's the question. Does this work in business, just canning a guy who's doing stuff you don't like?
Well, yes. It happens more often than you think at many large public companies. Some CEOs, frankly, have been known to fire folks quite often under them.
Charles Elson is the director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. There is, though, says Eleanor Powell, she teaches political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, something else to this whole thing.
The goal of any business is to make a profit and to maximize the profit that can be made, but a government isn't just trying to maximize a profit.
All of which is to say, we'll see where this whole thing goes. You know who does like to maximize profit, though? Wall Street equities today. If you were looking for a big reaction to the Comey news on the theory that it has delayed or derailed whatever economic policies the White House and congressional Republicans want to get done, well, fact is, the markets have known for a while. Things just aren't happening. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Elsewhere in news of key federal officials leaving their jobs with potentially huge implications for the United States and this economy, we take you now to the U.S. Census Bureau. John Thompson, director of that bureau, has announced his resignation in the midst of proposed budget cuts and cost overruns for the next decennial counting of noses, which is a bigger deal for businesses than you might think. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
The Bureau is left with no leader just months before it starts all the hiring and trial runs it has to do for the 2020 census. Sarah Butler is with National Economic Research Associates. She says an accurate population count is just one thing the census does.
There's a treasure trove of data that the census collects that's used in many, many important ways.
She says the census provides a baseline for economic analysis. Her group weighs its own surveys against it and makes projections based on historic trends. The census helps companies decide where to open new plants or stores.
Can you establish a business reliably related to population growth or income growth? Or is there a loss of population that might represent a potential risk?
The Census Bureau is improving its own data collection. In 2020, for the first time, Americans will be able to answer questions online and over the phone, cutting down on those door-to-door surveys. That requires a new IT system. Terry Ann Lowenthal is a consultant on census issues. She says it's supposed to save billions of dollars.
In the long run.
For now, the costs are mounting. The new system is 50% over budget. And the Trump administration has proposed a 10% cut to the department overall. Lowenthal says the new system is considered necessary, so
other operations could suffer.
Operations like marketing the census and more language translation. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We're doing a whole stream of coverage this year centered in Erie, Pennsylvania. It's a series we're calling The Big Promise, how President Trump's campaign promises are playing out in one specific community. A community, Erie County that is, that voted Obama-Trump in the last three election cycles. One of those big promises was more school choice, already one of the trickiest issues facing struggling school districts like the one in Erie. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is a big proponent of vouchers for private and religious schools and of charter schools as well. So it's likely there will be more of those on the way, which is making for some tough decisions in Erie, where the city school district is facing a $10 million hole in its budget. From our education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Here's how bad things have become for Erie's public school system. Earlier this year, Superintendent Jay Badhams proposed closing every one of the city's four high schools and paying tuition to send kids to better-funded schools in the surrounding county. Badhams says the pushback was intense.
One of the ones that sticks with me is that we hope you solve your financial problems. We don't want your troubled city kids out here in our county schools. Why do you think we moved out to the county in the first place? And some of them were far worse.
Another guy pulled Badhams aside at a hockey game and said city students might be met with guns at the town line. Badhams was trying to make a point. The majority of Erie's public school students live in poverty. Lots of them have learning disabilities or are just learning English. And partly because of Pennsylvania's convoluted funding formula, Erie City gets up to $3,000 less per student than schools in Erie County.
If we're going to be offering kids an inequitable high school experience, something that's vastly inferior to what's available to students outside the city limits, we thought it was an ethical decision.
In the end, the district made a less radical decision to consolidate its schools. Two high schools will become middle schools, and two elementary buildings will close. On a recent evening, the district's chief financial officer, Brian Polito, unveiled the plan to a packed gym at the JFK Neighborhood Center on Erie's east side. He started with the dire statistics. In the last 7 years, the district has closed three elementary schools, cut 350 jobs, and pared back arts, foreign language, and shop classes. Even after all that, Polito told the crowd,
if we don't take action to balance our budget this year, we run the real risk of running out of cash in May or June of 2018, which means
some of the pressure on the budget is coming from charter schools, which are publicly funded but privately run. More Erie families are choosing charters over what they see as failing district schools. That means the district now hands over nearly 15% of its budget to charter schools. If the Trump administration succeeds, more choice is on the way. Superintendent Badhams says the students who leave are scattered across the city, so the district doesn't save that much on overhead.
One of the fallacies of the whole notion of school choice as being a way to improve the actual public school system is that when you take resources away from the schools that you're hoping will compete, you make them less competitive.
One of the high schools slated to become a middle school is East High. The flags of 29 countries hang in the school's entryway, representing 270 students speaking 14 different languages. Erie is one of the country's top resettlement sites for refugees. Sally Kabengo, who arrived from Congo last year, is nervous about the switch.
I feel bad because I've been missing East High School.
You like East High School?
Yeah, I like East High School.
The grown-ups are worried, too, and fed up after years of cuts.
You can line up here.
At the community forum, parents line up at the microphone for questions. Juanita Stokes is a graduate of East High and a mom of three elementary school students.
How come Erie School District is always the first close of schools to close? We have had so many schools already closed. Our schools get the second hand. Like, they always get the crap. And that's what a lot of parents are tired of.
We're tired of it, too, an administrator tells her. Last year, the state adopted a new fair funding formula that factors in poverty and English language learners, but it only applies to funding increases, meaning the old inequities are baked in. The district is still hoping for a last-minute miracle when the state legislature passes its budget this summer. In Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
While France adjusts to its new power structure and the Brits get ready for their looming general election, Italy is still dealing with the European migrant crisis. Over the next couple of months, they're going to be building more detention centers to house mostly Middle Eastern and African migrants denied permission to stay in that country and thus who are going to be deported. The numbers are actually staggering. 50,000 people this year from Libya alone. This weekend, more than 6,000 people made the trip across the Mediterranean from North Africa in flimsy rubber dinghies and wooden boats. The BBC's Rita Chakrabarti was with one of the humanitarian aid ships.
We have two rubber boats, possibly also one wooden boat. Team, please prepare on deck for rescue.
We've been a week at sea in relative calm, but the Italian Coast Guard issues sudden orders. Several migrant vessels have been spotted near the Libyan coast.
It's okay?
Okay. Everything's okay.
The charity we're with, Save the Children, has been running rescue missions like this for several months now, but this is about to be the biggest operation they've ever undertaken. Initially, it looked like a familiar scene, but the scale of it was not. First there were three dinghies, then four, and then more and more appeared over the horizon. Hundreds and hundreds of people crammed into little rubber boats, the pancake-like vessels squashed under the weight, veering perilously across the water to try to get to us. Libya is key to this crisis. The collapse of the Gaddafi regime and the ensuing civil war has allowed criminals to establish a now flourishing trade. We repeatedly heard tales from migrant people who'd gone to Libya to work, but then found conditions there intolerable. People like Imran from Bangladesh, who worked there as a cook. He says he went months unpaid and was beaten if he asked for his wage. I asked him why he risked his life making this crossing. He told me he took the rubber boat because Libya was dangerous. He had a chance of life if he left. Libya was intolerable. He couldn't do it anymore.
We will do women and children first. It's very important that you stay calm.
Nearly 550 migrant people were eventually rescued by Save the Children, the largest number this charity has dealt with in this crisis. They're heading for Italy, where opinion, as in the rest of Europe, is hardening. Some claim these rescue missions are a taxi service for migrants, and an Italian prosecutor recently accused some aid agencies of colluding with Libyan people smugglers, a claim strongly denied by Gillian Moyes, who leads this onboard team.
Our sole mission is to save the lives of people, and especially children, who are escaping violence, persecution and extreme poverty. We have no contact whatsoever with people smugglers.
Last year broke records for the number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean, and this year looks set to top that. This has become an established ferry route run by ruthless criminals who have little care for their passengers' ultimate fate.
The BBC's Rita Chakrabarti afloat in the Mediterranean someplace. Coming up.
I knew that bus would pull up at 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock every day.
And she'd be there to meet it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 32 points, about a 10%, 20,943. NASDAQ up 8 points, about a 10%, 6129. S&P 500 up 2 points, a 10%, 2399. Like I said, not a whole lot of Comey action there. Microsoft aiming for the clouds, web-based computing services, going after its old rival Oracle. Microsoft up 0.4% today. Oracle up about a 10%. IBM, just for the heck of it, down about 0.5%, 0.5%. That's another way you say that. Charlie Brown and Snoopy are going to need heavier outerwear. Canada-based DHX Media is buying the entertainment division of the U.S.-based Iconics brand company, which licenses characters from that comic strip. Shares of Iconics down 4.2% today. DHX Media off about a 10%. Bonds down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.41%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We are well nigh onto summer job season, seasonal hiring, as the economists like to call it. And how that's going to work out for you depends on what side of the labor equation you're on. After years of teenagers and college students being out of luck, a low and getting lower unemployment rate means they will be in demand. For businesses, summer help is going to be harder to find and more expensive, especially at resorts, places that rely on temporary foreign workers to staff their hotels and their restaurants. Those folks typically come on what are called H-2B visas, and they're usually here by now. So as Marketplace's Rima Crace explains, for some tourist businesses, the summer is going to get off to a late and more costly start.
Annika Myers manages four tourist shops on Mackinac Island, Michigan.
We sell every souvenir item that you would want on your trip to Mackinac Island.
Polish pottery, antique cannons, plush toy horses. Myers says she usually brings in about 10 foreign workers to staff the stores. This year, she has one.
We're going to work a lot of overtime. The managers are having to work shifts in the stores, which they normally wouldn't have to do.
The H-2B program doles out about 66,000 visas to temporary workers every year in two equal groups. This year, more than 50,000 applications had already been filed by mid-January. Sarah Pierce is with the Migration Policy Institute. She says Congress has cleared the way for the limit to be lifted, but it's unclear when or if it'll happen.
And the application process for H-2Bs is actually quite extensive. So these workers, if they're going to bring in individuals for the summer, really need to know right away that they can do so.
In the meantime, it's all about the workaround. Some hotels and resorts have delayed their opening dates or cut back on their services. Sarah Diamond runs Beachmere Inn in Ogunquit, Maine. She's short 8 temporary workers who usually come from Jamaica. She says she's tried newspaper ads, social media, even referral bonuses. No response.
And we have to compete with places like Kennebunk and Kennebunk Port and Old Orchard Beach and York. There's a lot of seasonal demand here.
Diamond says she's waiting to hear what'll happen in D.C. Until then, she'll be making beds and scrubbing toilets herself. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
We aired the first part of a conversation yesterday with Susan Burton. She founded and runs a nonprofit that provides transitional living for women just getting out of prison. A new way of life, it's called. It's a reflection, really, of her life and the turns that it's taken.
The death of my son, KK, was sort of like the falling off place. I began to drink very heavily. That drinking escalated to drug use. The drug use sent me to prison.
So we're going to pick it up today with part two, our chat about her book, Becoming Ms. Burton.
People are released from prison so unprepared. They give you $200, and we call it gate money. And you pay for a bus ticket back to L.A. You get off the Greyhound bus, downtown Skid Row, and you're supposed to make a life from that. Many times I left the prison thinking, you know, I'm smart. I can make it. I won't get caught up again. But you get off downtown Skid Row, your target for all of the environmental harms in that area, the pain and trauma in that area is so thick you can almost reach your hand out and touch it. And you don't have clothing. You don't have a place to live. How do you make a life out of that? So ultimately, each time, I failed.
Except for the last time.
Yes. Well, I actually found a treatment facility in Santa Monica, California, that had this buffet of services. You could pick all the things that you need to repair your life.
And we should be clear here, Santa Monica and the place where you were could not be more different from Skid Row.
It could be. It's a whole different world. It's rich. It's white. It's resourced. And I began to, you know, use those resources. And then it dawned on me, why wasn't I offered this long, long time ago? You know, why wasn't it offered to people in South L.A. where the war on drugs had decimated that community?
Now you have this organization you run.
Yes.
A New Way of Life in which you offer services, help, and protection to women coming out of prison.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
So based on what I received in Santa Monica, I thought if we had this in South L.A., our community would be a lot better off. I worked a minimum wage job, saved $13,000, and got a little house. And when I got the house, I would go down to Skid Row, where I used to get off the bus. I knew that bus would pull up at 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock every day, delivering women from prison. And I'd say, hey, girl, I have a house. It's drug and alcohol free. If you want to go there, if you want a bed there, I have one for you. And some women came, some women didn't. But it wasn't long before the house was filled. There was 11 of us living in it. I slept in the dining room. That was my little office slash bedroom.
You bought bunk beds from IKEA, right?
I brought bunk beds from IKEA.
Yeah.
There was a beautiful community of women struggling to enter, but supporting each other in so many ways. If someone found a resource, they'd share that resource. We were a community of women, formerly incarcerated women, supporting one another.
I'm sure you've thought of this over the years. You have broken the cycle. You broke the cycle of violence, of drugs, of abuse. I'm sure you look back and say, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I look back and I think I feel so fortunate to have made the journey from all the pain and trauma to healing and health and life. Not only for me, but for many, many women and their children. One of the realities is that I can't bring my son back, but I can celebrate another woman getting her child back. And I can't take back the years that I spent traveling in and out of the prison system, but I can help another woman get her life back. So that's what I do.
Susan Burton, the book is called Becoming. Ms. Burton, thank you so much for your time.
You are so welcome.
Final note on the way out today, about which, in keeping with our theme, I've got some questions. Reuters and others are reporting this afternoon that the White House is likely, and that's the word Reuters uses, likely to ban laptops in passenger cabins on airliners coming from Europe. We're going to have to put them in our checked bags. Back in March, you might remember the Department of Homeland Security banned passenger cabin laptops in planes coming from 10 airports in the Middle East and North Africa. So here with my questions. Does this mean tablets, too? What are we supposed to do for 10 or 12 or 14 hours anyway? And if we're not allowed to put lithium-ion batteries, that is, laptop batteries, in our checked bags now because they might catch fire and blow up, Well, you see where I'm going with this, right? All right, we got to go. Dow off 32 points today, about a 10%, 20,943. NASDAQ up 8 points, 10%, 6129. S&P 500 up 2, a 10%, 2399. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.